Today is October 8th, 2018, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Jim Bertel in Washington. Coming up, a testy exchange between the U.S. Secretary of State and his Chinese counterpart as Mike Pompeo ends his trip to Asia.
I don't think that President Trump intended to increase the value of steel and increase steel production in this country for companies to use it like they're using it on us.
Unions say U.S. tariffs have increased company profits, but have not yet created jobs or improved wages and conditions for workers. And a young model's dream comes true. It's all in today's International Edition. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo wrapped up his four-nation tour of East Asia Monday. His final stop was in Beijing, where he and his Chinese counterpart expressed concerns about the actions of each other's governments. Pompeo traveled to China from South Korea, where he updated officials on his talks on Sunday with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. Joining me from Seoul is VOA's Steve Miller. Steve, what do we know about the outcomes of Secretary Pompeo's trip?
Well, on one hand, we know quite a bit, but on the other, we don't know a lot. So what we do know about this multi-nation, multi-day trip to Asia is that on his first stop in Japan, he met with Prime Minister Shinzo Abe to kind of give him a briefing, a heads up of what he planned to discuss in North Korea with Kim Jong-un, as well as confirm that he would bring up the issue of Japanese abductees to North Korea while there. In North Korea, we don't know a whole lot of the details that went on in the meeting with Kim Jong-un that lasted about 2 hours, but we do know it was well enough to go ahead and move forward with the possibility of scheduling a second summit between Kim and President Trump. We also know that from a readout that a State Department official said that the talks were better than last time, but also that there's also a long haul ahead to get to full denuclearization. From Pompeo's discussions with President Moon in South Korea, who he briefed on the outcomes in Pyongyang, we know that Moon was impressed enough and vowed to continue to do whatever was necessary to facilitate talks towards peace and denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. And finally, when Pompeo was in China on Monday, he spoke to his counterparts there about a wide range of subjects, didn't go into a lot of details, but he also briefed Chinese officials on what happened in North Korea. But as I said, overall, we don't know the detailed specifics of what each meeting took place, other than, you know, there seems to be a genuine consensus on those involved that the talks between Pompeo and Kim were positive.
You mentioned that there was a push for a second U.S.-North Korea summit. Any idea when that may happen?
Not exactly. I mean, what we do know is that Pompeo said that the kind of logistics that are necessary to facilitate a time and place were still being discussed, and that both sides were closer on selling them, but that more work was needed to be done. That's why we have these new working-level groups that are going to continue meeting to hammer out those kinds of details. However, Harry Kazianis from the National Interest told Reuters News Agency that he thinks that the summit is going to take place as soon as possible, perhaps before the midterm elections, to kind of carry through the momentum of the Kavanaugh confirmation to the Supreme Court, although others think that's just really too fast for anything meaningful to happen as a result of a second summit.
Well, the optics between Pompeo and Kim Jong-un in Pyongyang were very positive. How are experts reacting to the meeting?
Generally, a lot of the experts are pretty skeptical because, you know, we just don't have any substantial details of what has been discussed. That those details aren't coming forward. Now, granted, they all say we don't know what's really going on because these are taking place behind closed doors in these discussions, and they aren't privileged to that kind of information. However, they do point out that North Korea really hasn't done anything to show it's moving forward towards denuclearization, and that is a problem because the United States and North Korea are still on opposite ends of the spectrum when it comes to sanctions. The United States has said that denuclearization must take place before sanctions are removed, but North Korea, China, and Russia, as well as to a certain extent South Korea, are asking for sanctions to be lifted incrementally as North Korea acts in good faith. And that becomes a problem because the sanctions really come from the UN Security Council in terms of the most severe, most stricter. And if they are relaxed, and let's say that it may be difficult to reinstate them at a tougher level because China and Russia are on the Security Council as permanent members and have veto power. They also point out that a second summit really needs to come up with a major concession from North Korea. Some say it could be a full listing of their nuclear weapons and arsenal and test sites and so forth in exchange for a U.S. end of war declaration. But then they caution that if the U.S. does give that as a concession, as a way to get North Korea to list what it has, an end of war declaration could eventually lead to Pyongyang asking for troop removal from South Korea. I was speaking to Grant Newsham, who is with the Forum for Strategic Studies in Tokyo, and he says for him, you know, listing what North Korea has in terms of weapons and test sites is important, but a truly significant concession from North Korea wouldn't necessarily be that list. It would rather be a commitment from Pyongyang to pull back its conventional weapons from within striking distance of Seoul, because he says that's been a major hindrance to negotiating with North Korea for decades because of the potential threat it could do to South Korea. In any case, analysts really are looking for something very concrete for North Korea to do that isn't easily reversible to show that North Korea is serious about denuclearization.
VOA's Steve Miller in Seoul, thank you so much for staying on top of this important story.
My pleasure.
Among the top stories around the world, Turkish officials say a Saudi journalist was killed in the Saudi consulate in Istanbul. The Taliban is ordering its fighters to attack Afghans who are helping to organize this month's parliamentary elections. Hurricane Michael is expected to impact western Cuba before heading north through the Gulf of Mexico. And the Nobel Prize for Economics is awarded to two Americans. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the voanews.com website and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition.
In a minute.
The chemical makeup of Earth's atmosphere is said to contain about 78% nitrogen and 21% oxygen, with argon, carbon dioxide, and other gases making up the remaining 1%. But in the atmosphere of what is considered to be the hottest, ultra-hot exoplanet found so far, scientists in Switzerland and Germany say they have found vapors of iron and titanium. The scientists say they were able to detect these heavy metals because of the incredibly hot surface temperature of the planet. Discovered last year, the exoplanet KELT-9b is said to have a dayside temperature of between 3800 and 4300 degrees Celsius. Scientists say the reason the exoplanet is so hot is because it orbits its host star, which is almost twice as hot as our sun, from a distance that's 30 times closer than the Earth's distance from the sun. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo. Thank you for joining us for VOA's International Edition. China has acknowledged that it is investigating senior official Meng Hongwei, who also headed the global law enforcement agency Interpol, after he was reported missing last week after returning to his native China. The Beijing-based National Supervisory Commission, which handles corruption cases involving public officials, says Meng is currently under investigation on suspicion of violating the law. Soon afterwards, France-based Interpol said it received the 64-year-old Meng's resignation. He had been in the post since 2016 and was Interpol's first Chinese leader. Gordon Chang, a lawyer, author, and contributor to the Daily Beast website,
told VOA's Victor Beatty this could be part of a struggle within the Chinese Communist Party.
Obviously, there's some intense infighting at the top of the Communist Party, but we don't know the full extent of it. And at this particular time, I think only a small circle in Beijing really knows the story. There are many rumors, but it's going to take quite some time for us to figure out exactly what happened.
China has targeted a number of people. Part of President Xi Jinping's anti-corruption drive, is this part of that?
It could very well be, but the important point here is that because China has blackened its reputation in the international community, it's unlikely to be a run-of-the-mill corruption investigation, because China would not have done this and certainly wouldn't have done it in this fashion. It would seem that this has got to be extremely serious for them to have removed Meng in this particular fashion.
His case was brought under what's called the National Supervisory Commission, which handles corruption cases involving public servants, saying in a one-line statement that Mr. Meng is currently under investigation on suspicion of violating the law. We've seen this before, haven't we?
Well, we certainly have. You know, under Xi Jinping, there has been an unprecedented purge of officials. They say it's anti-corruption, but really what's going on here is Xi Jinping is removing people that he perceives to be a political opponent, because almost all officials in China are corrupt. They're not removed for corruption. They're removed because they're on the wrong side of a political controversy. For instance, we have not seen Xi Jinping move against his family, who have accumulated wealth in an unexplained manner. We have not seen Xi Jinping move against his political allies, but we have seen Xi Jinping put anti-corruption campaigners in jail, which really means that this is not about corruption. It's really about politics. And that's the way Chinese politics are being handled these days.
When Mr. Meng was elected head of Interpol back in 2016, there were some concerns raised that he would use it to help China target dissidents abroad under the guise of pursuing corrupt officials. In fact, during his brief tenure, Interpol issued a red notice for a fugitive Chinese billionaire. Obviously, it seems that the tables have been turned on him.
Well, certainly. And everyone was concerned about how the Chinese would use Interpol. But nobody, certainly not me, expected this turn of events. Because Meng was in such a advantageous position for China, we know this has got to be extremely serious for them to remove him and to do so under the circumstances, which are just extraordinary.
Meng's wife, Grace, told reporters in Lyon, France, she had not heard from her husband since September 25th and revealed that his last text message to her contained a kitchen knife emoji, what she believed to be a sign he is in danger. She said she has gone from sorrow and fear to a determination to pursue truth, justice, and responsibility so that husbands and fathers will no longer disappear. Indonesia is sending its children back to school 10 days after a quake and tsunami devastated the city of Palu. Students are pitching in to help clean up their classrooms and also providing a vital headcount for officials still trying to tally the loss of life. Reuters' Eve Johnson reports.
School is back in session 10 days after an earthquake and tsunami devastated the Indonesian city of Palu. Authorities calling students back to the classroom on Monday to help clean up and to provide a headcount as they try to figure out how many children survived the disaster and how many are not coming back. The official death toll stands at around 1,700. But according to officials from two hard-hit areas in the city, 5,000 more may still be missing. Although Indonesia's disaster relief agency says that figure isn't official yet.
It's not easy to record bodies still buried by rubble from landslides or mud, and efforts are still underway.
Experts say liquefaction was the biggest killer when the 7.5 magnitude quake turned the ground into a muddy mire, obliterating several neighborhoods in Palu. As hopes fade for survivors, authorities say they'll call off search and rescue operations on Thursday. Meanwhile, schools are trying to provide much-needed support.
We're trying to help the children overcome their trauma. We want to encourage them so they'll want to come back. We actually had some kids show up yesterday simply because they missed school.
But the empty hallways are also a grim reminder. At one school, fewer than 50 out of nearly 700 students showed up. The principal said that so far, only a handful of those missing had been confirmed dead. Many, he said, are struggling with fear. and not ready to go back to school just yet.
That is Reuters' Eve Johnson reporting. American labor unions are increasingly skeptical that U.S. President Donald Trump's tariffs on countries like China will significantly increase manufacturing jobs, wages, and conditions for workers in the United States. The president began to impose 25% tariffs on imported steel and 10% on aluminum in March of this year. Since then, metal prices have increased by 30% and profits for American steel companies have soared. But VOA's Brian Patton reports that union workers say they aren't sharing in it.
At the Bull Moose Tube Piping Factory in the southern state of Georgia, 56 United Steelworker members have been locked out of their workplace for rejecting a new contract. It would offset a modest pay raise by forcing workers to pay significantly more for health insurance.
I don't think that President Trump intended to increase the value of steel and increase steel production in this country for companies to use it like they're using it on us.
Over 30,000 United Steelworker members recently voted to authorize strikes against two companies if similar contract talks fail to produce significant wage increases while preserving benefits. Major labor organizations have supported Trump's tariffs, even though increased steel prices could hurt auto workers and other unions.
The labor movement is it's a kind of fractured universe with a lot of different interests among it. But one theme that does prevail, at least in the rhetoric of labor, is the notion of solidarity.
But union leaders say tariffs need to be part of a strategy that creates jobs by investing in infrastructure and training and by ending corporate tax cuts for moving jobs overseas. Unions are also adamantly opposed to most of Trump's economic agenda, which favors tax cuts for the rich and restrictive anti-immigrant policies.
Unions see immigrants as a strong source of future union members, and of course the president is trying to dampen down immigration.
President Trump touted pro-labor requirements in the renegotiated free trade agreement with Mexico and Canada, now called USMCA, stipulating that 30% of cars must be made by workers earning $16 an hour and easing restrictions on unions in Mexico. The AFL-CIO called USMCA a good start, but wants to see how labor protections are enforced before rendering judgment. A federation of labor unions, the AFL-CIO, represents 12.5 million workers. Brian Patton, VOA News, Washington.
For more of our continuing coverage of President Trump's tariffs, please visit us at voanews.com. I'm Jim Bertel, and you're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
Hi, I'm Larry London, and I'm the host of Border Crossings, inviting you to join me for one of the best hours of request music possible on the radio. We've got all your favorite songs by your favorite singers. You tell us what to play. It's requests and dedications, and it happens every weekday right here on The Voice of America.
Hi, I'm Nikki Strong. You love music? How about Blake Shelton and Carrie Underwood? Or Merle Haggard and Loretta Lynn? Experience the best in country music on Country Hits USA. I bring you some country rock, outlaw, a little hillbilly, contemporary, and more, with a dash of entertainment news, too. So join me for Country Hits USA on VOA 1, the Voice of America.
This is International Edition from VOA. A new UN report says temperatures are likely to rise by 1.5 degrees Celsius between 2030 and 2052 if global warming continues at its current pace and if the world fails to take rapid and unprecedented measures to stem the increase. Reuters' Maya Wormsley reports.
A stark warning from the United Nations Panel on Climate. Unprecedented changes are needed across the world to prevent a temperature rise, which would increase heat waves, flooding, drought, and the loss of species.
The pledges that governments have made over the last 3 years are not enough to keep warming below 1.5 degrees C, even with ambitious and very challenging efforts after 2030.
The preferred 1.5-degree target was set at the 2015 Paris Agreement. But the report suggests the world is off track and heading towards 3 degrees instead. That would mean huge changes for the world, including coral reefs being virtually wiped out and more deadly wildfires as seen in Europe this summer. The window of opportunity to make a change is not yet closed, but urgent action is needed and fast. The report is seen as the main guide for governments on how to implement the Paris Accord and could prove vital when world powers meet for the next climate change conference in Poland this December.
That's Reuters' Maya Wormsley reporting. Well, it's Fashion Week season, and major cities around the world are gearing up to show off the latest trends in high fashion clothing and accessories. It's also a busy time for the world's top supermodels, who will grace the catwalks and runways in New York, London, Milan, and Paris. VOA's Laura Sepulveda took in one of the more exclusive runways in New York City, where one model with Down syndrome saw her dream come true.
21-year-old Mariana Avila has loved fashion shows and excitement of the catwalk since she was a child. Enjoying Fashion Week in New York City is a dream come true. Mariana was born with Down syndrome, but she never thought of her condition as an impediment to her real dream. A dream she has pursued her entire life, to become a fashion model.
I used to always say it, I want to be a model, singer, and actress.
Marianne's frequent posting over her love for fashion attracted the attention of another model, Mackenzie Dugmore, who was immediately intrigued.
So I was actually scrolling through my Facebook feed when I came across her picture and a heading that said something about a Down syndrome model whose dream was to walk in New York Fashion Week. And I was just like, oh my gosh, like I have the power to make her dream come true. Why wouldn't I do it?
Through the Messenger app, Avila received a special invitation to take part in the Talisha White designer presentation in New York, an invitation she eagerly accepted. She says the process was more difficult than she imagined, but after rehearsing, measuring her outfit, and meeting the designer, Avila was ready to walk the runway in one of the most important fashion events in the world.
I was told, and I thought it has to be a joke, but it was real. My dream came true.
Talisha White is one of many designers who have begun to introduce a more diverse group of women in their show. The trend has prompted being named fashion brands to introduce plus-size models, women wearing hijabs, and models with disabilities on the runway and in ads.
I absolutely love modeling for Talisha because of her brand. She loves empowering young women, all shapes and sizes. I absolutely love that.
And so, with the confidence that comes from years of dreaming, Avila walked the runway for the first time, wearing a dazzling blue dress.
I like to smile. My mouth, because I have a very nice mouth. My smile and my teeth, too. I like to smile and my hair. It's great. My hair is very beautiful.
A beautiful dream that became reality for a young fashion-conscious woman who doesn't fit the image of a typical model. And she is not the only one. For many, the Talisha White presentation reinforces the message that women are beautiful, no matter their size, their color of their skin. Mariana Avila is certainly proof of that. Laura Sepúlveda, VOA News, New York.
You've been listening to International Edition. You can find us at voanews.com and on the VOA mobile app. Thanks for joining us, and thanks to our director, Patrice Martin, and our engineer, John Dryden. I'm Jim Bertel in Washington. Thanks for listening.